Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 69 of the Lesbian Book Club podcast. This month we have an interview with UK author Kate Davis, and you're going to want to stick around to hear that because she is really fantastic. But first, let's see what's hot in the US and UK Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as well as finding out what's going on in the world of lesfic and what's going on in the world of me. First up, the Amazon charts. And topping the charts in the US, as I record this on May the 26th, is The Priory of the Orange Tree by Samantha Shannon. Now, this one has been kicking around for quite some time now, and it's got over 4,000 reviews. 4,000! I mean, that is phenomenal. So it's clearly really popular with readers around the world. So if science fiction and fantasy is your bag, and dragons, yes, it's got dragons, go for your life. Download this one. Only $1.99, a bargain. Also doing well is Anna Stone with her latest, Forever Theirs, which is Mistress Book 3. Now, this one has a lady on the cover with skin so shiny in Photoshop, it actually made me blink and then blink again. And it's about a billionaire executive and her glamorous fashion designer girlfriend. And together, this couple are determined to make one unassuming lady theirs. Ooh la la, I say. This one sounds a little different from the norm. It's, if you fancy a tale of a florist falling for two mistresses, and who wouldn't, this one could be right up your street. Also riding high in the US charts is Bryce Oakley with her book Nevermine. This one mines the tried and tested fake relationship trope with Sage, a sports star with a messy reputation, agreeing to accompany Willa to her ex's wedding. Now, of course, it's just for show until it's not. If a romance with a pro soccer star is what you've been waiting, nay, longing for all year long, it's there. It's out in the charts now. Go and read it. Now, I also assume that Miranda McLeod's Heart in Motion was a medical drama because there's a lady on the front in a white coat with a stethoscope. However, yes, there is a bit of medical in it. Said lady is a ER doctor, I think. But this one sounds a bit weepy rather than a full-on medical drama. There is a doctor. There is a tragic backstory. There are orphan children. And there's love blossoming against a custody battle. Love blossoming against custard would be a lot more jolly, wouldn't it? I mean, as light reads go, it doesn't sound like one, but Miranda is a fabulous author, so I think you're in safe hands. Just bring a box of tissues. Finally in the US, Carol Wyatt is top five with her book Daring to Dream. This one has a Beyoncé alike on the cover and is described as a steamy Hollywood age gap romance. That's trope bingo right there. Jackie and Henley are the game ladies, and I think we all know there's going to be lust, heartbreak and a champagne popping ending, so you go girls. In the UK, the charts are still full of traditionally published books, some with queer protagonists and others just in the wrong category. But of those, Claire Chambers' Small Pleasures is gorgeous and heartbreaking all at the same time, and Emma Donoghue's The Pull of the Stars has won a ton of plaudits and awards, and Emma Donoghue's always good for a fab novel. Meanwhile, Kristen Zimmer's When Sparks Fly is a queer YA novel that's described as absolutely addictive. See if you agree. It's $1.99 right now. Okay, so that's it from the charts. Let's head on over to the world of lesfic. And in the world of lesfic, the finalists for the Golden Crown Literary Society Awards, the Goldies to its mates, have been announced. The event itself is online again this year because of the pandemic, and it takes place in July, I think the first or second weekend. There are quite a few categories, and well over 100 books are finalists in them. So if you want to have a look at all the finalists and learn more, head on over to the website. I think it's gcls.org, but just put Golden Crown Literary Society into Google and Google will furnish you with a web address. Included are all the usual suspects, including Melissa Braden, Georgia Beers, Anne McMahon, Claire Ashton, Jay, EJ Noyes, and host of others. But one thing that is different this year, also included, is me. Yes, I don't normally enter these awards. I haven't done so for about 5 years, but I decided to enter this year because a number of readers got in contact with me and asked me to enter Before You Say I Do into the awards. So I did. I was amazed and happy to be a finalist in the Contemporary Romance Short Novels category. This one is for books up to 70,000 words, and Before You Say I Do just squeaked in under the line because it's 69,000 words. So I'm in good company in that category with the likes of Lola Keeley, Chris Bryant, Elle Spencer, A.E. Radley and Lucy Bexley. So I'm hoping for a night of glitter and authors winning gongs. Yeah, whatever happens, it's nice to be part of it. The Lambda Literary Awards are also taking place, and the virtual ceremony takes place next week, actually, on June the 1st. So I will report back on the winners in that one next month when I get them. So exciting awards times. Let's go on to the world of me. As for me, so I have been absent from this podcast for about 2.5 months. I apologise for the break, but I had a bit of a family emergency to deal with, and so everything fell off my radar for at least a month. So, but luckily it's all been sorted now, and I was able to reschedule this interview, which you're going to hear in a few moments, with Kate Davies, which is really great. She was such a fantastic guest, so you're going to love it. And I now have a few other interviews lined up, so providing nothing else goes pear-shaped, and we should get back on track for a podcast every month for the next few months. So since I last spoke to you in March, I've been trying to write, failing a bit because of circumstance, but then succeeding on some days, which are always the happier days. Big London Dreams is the next book to come out, and that one is with the editor right now. It is up for pre-order on Amazon, Apple Books and Barnes & Noble. Head to my website for more at www.clairelydon.co.uk if you want to find out all about it and pre-order. It's going to come out on July the 28th. Big London Dreams is the story of Eunice and Joan from London Romance Book 7, which was Hot London Nights. They were the secondary romance in that book, and they have been upgraded to the main characters in Book 8. It's also my first crack at historical romance, and I hope I do an okay job. I really enjoyed writing it. This one is a bit personal. It's set in London in the 50s, and while I was not around in London in the 50s, my parents were, and they met in London in the 50s. So they've been a great source of inspiration, telling me bits and bobs about that time and what was going on and what was happening. In fact, the ladies, Eunice and Joan, meet while working at a clothes factory just off Oxford Street, which is where my mum used to work. Obviously, I've made up the factory, but you know, she did used to work off Oxford Street. She was a machinist. So I love doing the research for this one as well, not just for my mum and dad, just reading books and looking at old YouTube videos and just finding out a few gems about how it was to be in London in the 50s and what it used to be like. I'm excited for people to read this one, and I hope you enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to your feedback. Right now I'm working on a new book, as yet untitled. I'm still feeling my way into it, still feeling my way into the first 20,000. It's trundling along. That should be with you later on in the year. I don't have a title yet. I'm a bit rubbish on the title for this one. I have a cover design and booked over for July, so I better get a title, hadn't I? Because it's handy for your cover designer to have a title to put on a book, so I've heard. In audiobook news, which I hope you are fans of, seeing as you are listening to this podcast, I've released two audiobooks since we last spoke. The Long Weekend is now out in audio, narrated by the fabulous Claire Story. And she's done a really great job on that one. And also, Hot London Nights, London Romance Book 7 is out now as well. And that is narrated by Lucy Price Lewis, who's done the rest of the series. So if you're an audiobook fan, do give those a listen. They are available on Audible, Apple Books, Amazon, and then across Kobo, Google Play, and wherever audiobooks are sold and streamed. June is also a big month for me coming up in translations, because Before You Say I Do is due out in Brazilian Portuguese, and A Taste of Love is out in German. That's both in June, so I'll let you know when they both come out for sure, but really excited for both of those. Anyway, enough about me. Let's get on to the interview with the fabulous Kate Davies. Enjoy. Joining me today is UK author Kate Davis. Kate is a novelist, screenwriter, and author of children's books. Her debut novel, In at the Deep End, won the 2020 Polari Prize and was shortlisted for the Bollinger Everyman Wodehouse Prize for Comic Fiction. The Guardian described it as, without doubt, the after-party book for anyone looking to continue their Fleabag fun. She lives in London with her wife. So, hello, Kate. How are you today?
Hi, I'm not too bad. Thank you very much for having me. How long the Wodehouse Prize name is. I don't know. It's so many sponsors, it's really hard to say the name of that prize.
It's so difficult. I was like, Wodehouse? I don't know. I kind of went for an in-betweeny version, so I think I got away with it. You know, that whole quote from The Guardian, you must have been pretty pleased when you saw that. Did you think, my work here is done?
I kind of did. I mean, you know, it's never done. Are you ever satisfied with anything? I don't know if I am. But I was really, really pleased, especially with the Fleabag comparison. That was very... I loved Fleabag, so I was very pleased with that. That was brilliant.
Yes. No, yeah. I can definitely see the comparisons. So tell me a bit about where you are talking to us from today. What can you see? Where are you? What can you see from where you're sitting?
I am sitting in... I have a little tiny office at the top of my house, and I'm sitting in there at my desk. And I can see, I bought some fairy lights in lockdown because I found it quite depressing. So I'm looking at my fairy lights, got a notice board, which has got some like supposedly inspirational things on it. Like I've got the word Frankenstein on a post-it. I can't remember why that's there. And I've got a sign that says, "What would Tina do?" Which me and my friend used to write sitcoms together. And we used to be really obsessed with Tina Fey, who is now maybe a slightly problematic character. But anyway, she made me that in 2011.
I actually bought some fairy lights in lockdown for the same reason. And then mine have got like 9 different settings and they started giving me headaches and migraines. I had to turn them off.
They like automatically come in the flashing setting. I'm like, who wants to see flashing lights? No one, surely. Surely the automatic should be the still light.
Yeah, and the still ones are the 9th setting. So I just get fed up of like clicking through. So I never have them on anymore. They're just here. So, well, I hope they've cheered you up in lockdown. Good.
Yeah.
You were saying that you've written children's books and I think you've been a book editor. So writing a lesbian rom-com is the obvious next step, isn't it? So tell me a little bit about your writing journey and how you got started.
Well, when I was at school and university, I used to write stories at school, but I mean, I didn't try very hard, never really thought I would be a writer. And then when I was at university, I did, and school, I did some work experience at Penguin Books and thought that it was the most glamorous thing I'd ever done in my whole life. It was like when I was 16, I did it, so it was the 90s. It was just, they were so cool, the people at Penguin Books. And I went back and went to Puffin Books when I was at university for a couple of weeks, and I really, really wanted to be a children's fiction editor. I just didn't think I could do it myself, really. But it's very hard to get a job in publishing, so I tried for ages and ages, and I couldn't get a job. And eventually, after working for the Home Office for a year, I managed to get a job at Usborne Publishing, which is a children's book publisher where they write all of their books in-house. And it was the first time I'd considered writing, because I kind of turned up there and just wrote a lot of non-fiction books. So that was the job, which was really interesting and really fun. I'd never really thought about non-fiction before. And then I kind of ended up in non-fiction as an editor, which wasn't where I'd wanted to be really. But I loved writing the books. I loved seeing my name on the books. I loved, you know, creating and communicating and working with illustrators and all that stuff. And lots of people who'd worked at Usborne, the woman who wrote Gossip Girl had worked at Usborne, mm-hmm. Philip Arder had worked at Usborne, Non Pratt, who's a YA writer, Kat Clark, who's a YA writer and a now quite a very successful screenwriter, like so many people had worked there, and I mean loads of people, and then left to be fiction writers. So I thought, oh, hang on a second, if these people can do it, I can do it. And then I moved to Scholastic Books and worked on The Horrible History because I really loved comedy, which was that was really fun. And then I kind of started reading fiction manuscripts with the fiction team. And when you see a fiction manuscript before it's been edited, when it's being submitted by agents, you realise that it's not perfect. And I think it was really useful to see books in their unpolished form, because it made me think it was more achievable than it had seemed before. When you're reading a kind of finished manuscript, it seems like, how on earth did that person do that? I couldn't do it. But when you're seeing it in its unedited form, it seemed more achievable. Yeah, when I was working at Scholastic, I decided to start writing. And me and my friend Sarah, who's also she's a TV writer. I met her at Osborne Publishing. She's also a children's writer. We used to write sitcom scripts together. We were trying to write, because we knew this woman had written Gossip Girl, we tried to write like an English Gossip Girl, and we wrote this sitcom script that got shortlisted for a couple of competitions. And after that, I did a screenwriting class, and I started writing In the Deep End as a screenplay. It's like a rom-com, like a silly rom-com screenplay. Yeah. And this was like 2011. It was just absolutely no way. I mean, first of all, that it would ever have got made. And second of all, no one wanted like really gay stories like that in 2011. But luckily, it took me a really long time to write it. Eventually, I then stopped writing it as a film and started writing it as a very Bridget Jones-style novel. And it took me ages. And by the time I'd finished it, the world had changed. So,
hooray.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Procrastination worked out in the end.
Yeah, yeah. So what you're saying is, if anybody wants to be a novelist, just go and work in a non-fiction publisher.
This is a thing. It was easy to do that. Obviously, anyone can be a novelist just by reading things. But I think the most important thing is to realise that the things that you read in bookshops, buy from bookshops, have been edited and worked on for ages by a load of professionals, and you don't need to be that good. I think it's less intimidating than it seems, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, I imagine that was quite sort of eye-opening, seeing all these different manuscripts come in, and just like you say, sort of maybe second or third draft, and then, yeah, so before they get polished. Yeah, definitely. So I read In at the Deep End, and I really loved it. It's a terrific lesbian coming-of-age tale with humour and heart and so much fisting it'll make your eyes water. And it's about Julia's struggle to find herself, as well as some sex she actually enjoys. So as you just sort of touched on it there, and you said it took you, how many years, like 5 or 6 years, something like that?
About 8 years. Well, I started the screenplay, it was in 2010. Then I started the novel in 2011 in NaNoWriMo. Recommend NaNoWriMo for getting stuff done.
Yeah.
that took me about a year or two years. And it was a diary. It was like, it was literally a ripoff of Bridget Jones's diary. And then I kind of read it back and hated it. I hated it, but there were some things I liked about it. I liked the mysterious bits about it. So I kind of decided to rewrite it as a kind of more serious novel about an abusive relationship, but I've never been that serious, so the kind of humour stayed in it, really. And it took me, I just rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it, and I think that's how I learned to write, was by rewriting that novel about, I mean, not even, probably about 9 times. And I am a bit of a perfectionist, and I didn't want to send it to an agent until I thought it was really, really the best I could make it. So I think I was, I didn't send it to an agent until 2017. So that's pretty long time. And I was doing some other stuff in the meantime. I wrote a series of middle grade novels. Obviously I had a job, I was writing sitcom scripts and stuff. So it wasn't the only thing I was doing, but it was the main thing. You know, I saw it as my way out of my job. Yeah. And that's really a great idea, to be honest, to see writing a novel as a way out of your job, because, you know, you never know how much you're going to get for it. And, you know, I think I was quite lucky, and I had other kind of, it wasn't this, like, writing novels is not my only job. I think that if writing novels was my only job, I'd find it a lot more stressful than I do. But yeah, and then I kind of finally had it in this form where I just felt like I couldn't do anything more, and I sent it to agents, and I got quite a good response, which was amazing, brilliant. Shall I tell you about that stuff?
Yeah, go on, tell me all about it.
I sent it to, I kind of read all this stuff, like how to do it, you know, and I had a spreadsheet with like agents' names, different agents at different agencies, and I sent it to 5 of them. And an editor I knew who'd read the book, had like mentioned my book to a couple of them, so they read it quite quickly, which is, well, the three chapters, they'd read them quite quickly, which was great, because then they requested the manuscript. And this is my hot tip, if anyone's sending their book out to agents: if you get someone requesting the full manuscript, then email all of the other agents, and in the subject line say "full manuscript request," and so that they know, so the other agents know that this is like a hot book that they should be like prioritizing. So I did that, and I think most of them, I think I sent it to 7 in the end, and 5 of them wanted to meet, and I met them all, and they all had really different ideas about what the book should be. And some of them thought it should be more of a thriller and I should cut out the jokes. And some of them thought I should have flashbacks in it. And, you know, all like some of them thought, one woman thought I should cut out the sex, it was too much. But the agent I went with, who also represents Sarah Waters, so she loves a lesbian sex scene, she was like, I want you to put more sex in. And she loved the funny stuff, and she wanted me to make it more funny and add in more storylines. Because when I sent it to her, it was kind of just, if anyone's read the book, Julia, the main character, and her relationship with Sam was really the main storyline. And there were like a few incidental characters, but not very many. And she kind of encouraged me to really flesh out Julia's world. And I think that was really good advice. And I kind of liked her vision for the book the most. She was the most enthusiastic. So
That's
how
Yeah, I think that's always the thing to do, isn't it? If you're going for an agent, go with the one who is the most enthusiastic and goes with the original vision and maybe adds to it a little bit. That sounds like, you know, the best thing. I'm glad you didn't turn it into a thriller.
So, and someone else wanted to turn it into like a kind of serious novel, you know, a kind of more literary, more serious novel. And just none of these things were what I had intended it to be. So,
Yeah, and as you said, it is a lovely sort of step into the London lesbian scene. I think you did get that really spot on. It deals with the trauma of being in your 20s, flat sharing, going out with the wrong people, all that sort of thing. Did you pull from your own life for some of this?
I did. I mean, yes. The details I pulled from my own life. The horrible, the listening to your flatmates having sex is a non-fiction. I mean, a lot of it was quite non-fiction. The club, and I wanted it to be set in real places because I love that feeling. One of my favourite novels is Heartburn by Nora Ephron, which is very short and I think one of the most perfect novels. And she just writes about New York as if you know where you know where she's talking about, and you feel like you could be walking down the streets of New York. And I wanted her to have that real feeling of place, so that I, as if I'm assuming that you all know where I'm talking about, and I wanted the places all to be real places I've been to kind of celebrate queer London.
Mm-hmm.
And so much fun in the past.
Yeah.
Not currently, I'm fun in queer London, but I wanted it to be a kind of celebration. So yeah, and like the Julia, the character, works in for the civil service. I worked at the Home Office for a while, stuff like that. But the characters aren't real, but a lot of the situations are real and the details are real, because I don't know, that I think I write best, lots of people write best from a place of kind of grounded in truth, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think all the details really do sort of pulse with realism. So yeah, I think you did get that really spot on. And as you said, but I think the two things that really stand out is, you know, the humour in it, but also there is a lot of sex in this book, which is, and I think you handled all the scenes very well. So do you have any tips for writing great sex scenes? I ask a lot of people this when I'm interviewing them, and I'm always interested to hear the answer.
Yeah, so it's very strange because I'm not a person that really talks about sex that much. Like, I don't consider myself to be a really sexy person, but I really wanted to write about it. Like, I found in the first draft that I wrote that was really Bridget Jonesy, while I was writing it, I'd read this book called Wetlands. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's by a woman called Charlotte Roche, I think. And it's a German writer. And it is an absolutely obscene book. It's so obscene, I can't even tell you. It's a first-person narrative about this woman who's in hospital. She's had some, like, prolapse. And it's, like, incredible graphic detail about, like, bodily functions and sex.
Yeah.
And I was just on the tube genuinely, like, gasping and shutting the book so no one would read it. But I think it took away a layer of self-consciousness. And when I came to write the sex scenes, like, I just didn't have, it sort of took away my inhibitions temporarily, basically. And when I was rereading the book, I was like, well, obviously I'm going to cut out all these sex scenes. But then I kind of realized that they were the most powerful things in the book. And so I suppose my tips for writing sex scenes are, first of all, write stuff that shocks you. Write stuff, well, this is my opinion about sex scenes, like this, for this book it was important. I wanted to write stuff that I was embarrassed to say out loud. Like, there's stuff in that book that I'm embarrassed to read out loud. That's part of the strength of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my other thing about sex scenes is, don't use adjectives or metaphors. So I went to the Bad Sex Awards once, which is this prize for what they can put the literary review, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
They think there shouldn't be sex scenes in literary novels, and I disagree with them. But they have like a short list of terrible sex scenes from literary novels, and they are terrible sex scenes. And the reason they're terrible is because they're using a lot of terrible metaphors and adjectives. And I, you know, like something, there was one that was like, he burrowed into her like a rat into wet sand. And I was just like, I mean, do you want to be thinking about that in a sexy moment? There's another one that was like, he pinned her down like a lepidopterist pinning a butterfly to a board. And again, it's like, we're kind of talking about like animals and murdering while we're talking about sex. And I think just don't. Just use really direct language, say exactly what's going on, and don't try and be literary about it. Just don't do it, because it's embarrassing. That's my main sex reading tip.
Yeah, very good tips. I do another podcast called Lesbians Who Write with a fellow author friend, and we did a whole podcast on sort of language not to use. And one of the phrases that came up there was weeping love canal. I was like, what? I mean, it's just not sexy, is it?
It's really not.
No.
Just don't do it.
No. So, and as I said as well, I loved all the sex scenes in it, and then all the comedy is what I remember most as well. You've got a great turn of phrase, and I was snorting as I was reading it, so that's always a good sign. And Julia's inner thoughts were really funny. So how easy was Julia to come up with as a character, and also did your background in writing comedy scripts come in handy for the laughs?
Yeah, I didn't. I forgot to say that before I did this screenwriting course, I did a stand-up comedy writing course. Uh-huh. And that was amazing, because I'd done a bit of burlesque. Oh, this is a long story. I'd done a bit of burlesque, and I realised.
Sorry, how do you just sort of, kind of do a bit of burlesque? How did that come about?
I did like a workshop, like a cabaret workshop. It was like a youth... I don't think it was a youth theatre, sorry, that would be quite weird. It was like a young person's theatre thing at the Battersea Arts Centre in London, and me and my friend ended up doing a burlesque routine. Okay. And then we just started performing burlesque. And but then one night it went really badly wrong, and I got booed off stage. I was dressed as I was doing a balloon dance, which is where you pop balloons until you're naked. But it was bingo themed, because I always wanted it to be funny. So all of the balloons had bingo ball numbers on it, and anyway, basically it went really horribly wrong, and I got booed off stage, and the DJ said, come on lads, you got a tit tat, give her a round of applause. And that was when I realized that it was basically stripping, because before then I'd been like, oh, this is hilarious cabaret comedy, and it was usually kind of women in the crowds that I was performing in, but this particular gig was not women, and it was very disturbing and creepy. And it was like the ultimate experience of dying on stage, because I've been like trying to be funny and entertaining, and people literally were booing me, and I was naked.
Yeah, that's so
quite bad, quite a dark time. And I was like, well, if I can do that and survive, which I did, while not wearing any clothes, then surely stand-up comedy is going to be really easy, because I'll be wearing clothes. So, I mean, that's already a win.
It's a low bar.
It's a low bar. So I did a stand-up course. Turns out, it's still really horrible dying when you're wearing clothes. So I lasted for about three gigs, and then I like stopped. But that was kind of the beginning of like writing comedy. I loved writing comedy and writing comedy scripts. And I used to love, I don't watch so many at the moment, but I used to just love watching like really kind of joke intense American sitcoms and joyful sitcoms. And that's what I was interested in. And I just didn't really see the point of writing unless it was going to make people laugh. And I also, I tried when I was at Osborne Publishing, like I said, I tried to write books, but I always found it really kind of humiliating writing description, because it just felt really pretentious and like I was trying too hard. Mm-hmm. But when I wrote dialogue in my screenwriting class, I was like, I can do this. This is fine, because I'm just sort of reporting what people are saying. It just felt a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And it came more naturally. So that's kind of how I got into writing, was through dialogue, and that's why there's so much dialogue in my book. I can't even remember where you started. I've just been rambling madly. But comedy writing script, yeah, that's massive. That's kind of where it all came from, really.
Yeah.
The script writing is how I started. It's how I kind of found a way in.
Yeah. So do you start off with dialogue when you're writing?
No, I don't. I mean, in the beginning, like, the first draft of In the Deep End was kind of a film, so that was quite... Yeah, and I just find that when I'm writing a scene, I'll just be like, they were here, and then I'll just sort of write the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I find it kind of, it takes an effort for me to sort of fill in the stuff around the dialogue. Mm-hmm. Because that's what I find the most fun, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know, obviously, you were talking about your screenwriting. Are you planning on turning, like, in Deep End, going to try to turn it into a screenplay and try and get it made into a movie now?
That's the hope. So we'll have to see. It's kind of been like up and down, the kind of process, so I'm still waiting to see if it'll happen. I mean, lots of things never happen. You know, they like people talk about making them and never do. But I'm still hopeful that at some point it will happen.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah, I think it'd be a great movie. And as well as Julia, you had a cast of secondary character was pretty broad in At the Deep End, and they all added to the novel. Julia's flatmates, her colleagues, her family, and an elderly war veteran she's pen pals with. How is it writing the secondary characters? Did you have a favourite one of those?
Yeah, I really liked Eric, the elderly war veteran. He was my favourite. Mm. He came in right at the end when I was talking to, when my agent sort of suggested I bring in some more characters. But I when I was at one of my other publishing jobs, I did a book about the Second World War, and I interviewed loads of war veterans for that.
Okay.
And it was amazing talking to them about their experiences and also their turns of phrase, just little phrases that my gran used to use. She died when she was 96 in 2013, so you know she'd have been like 100 and something now, and just little turns of phrase that she used that I put into that character that I don't know, I felt very warm towards that character.
Yeah.
And I had loads of fun writing the parents, and yeah, it's just the whole thing was quite fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, my next book that I'm writing, I don't have quite as many secondary characters, but I felt like, so I kind of wonder if I should put more in. But maybe that comes later.
And as you said before, the novel has been compared to Bridget Jones' Diary, 50 Shades of Grey, Fleabag and Girls. So which one would you say it resembles the most, or are you happy with any, all of them?
Well, I mean, as I say, did start off basically ripping off Bridget Jones. So yes, that is not an accidental comparison. That is definitely, that was where the voice, she inspired my voice, not just the voice for this novel, but I read Bridget Jones when I was about 15 or 16, and I was obsessed with it, absolutely obsessed with it. And it changed the way me and my friends spoke to each other. Like, we would text each other like Bridget, like VG, and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of like changed the way that I spoke and wrote anyway.
Right.
That is where a lot of the kind of humour and the voice comes from, I think, of Julia. Not mad keen on 50 Shades of Grey, but you know, I don't mind if it reminds some people of that. I haven't actually read it myself. And Girls, I think, again, was a big influence on me. I really enjoyed Girls, and I loved the frankness of it, and that definitely influenced the way I wrote. And I wrote it before Fleabag, but obviously delighted to be compared to Fleabag because it's amazing. It's a work of genius.
No, yeah. Absolutely. And as you said, like when you first sort of thought about approaching agents, nobody really wanted queer stories. Now the market is sort of catching up, you know. When I thought about publishing in 2013, nobody wanted any lesbian romances, you know. It just wasn't a thing. And I don't know if you've read Kirsty Ayers' Cowgirl.
I haven't, but I've heard so much about it. I really ought to read it.
Yeah. It's
I had a musical called Menstruation the Musical in it, which is so weird because there's a Menstruation the Musical in it at the Deep End. So I need to read it.
There you go. Yeah, I interviewed her for this podcast, and I actually read Kirsty's, strangely, she's a friend of my cousin's, so that's how we got introduced. And I read a very early draft of Cowgirl, and that was also like in diary format. It must have been a thing around that time, right? But that is also a really fantastic queer rom-com. But again, when I first spoke to her in 2015, I said, you know, nobody's going to want this story. But yeah, 4 years later, everybody wanted the story. Yeah. So as you said, like, times have really changed. So you did publish right at the right moment. So well done.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. And obviously, the book also won the Polari Prize in 2020, which is amazing. So huge congratulations to for that. And obviously, it was in lockdown. So was that all on Zoom, the thing? And how did you celebrate?
Yeah, it was a bit crap, wasn't it? Because it could have been at the, you know, you win a prize. And it should have been at the bank centre. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, you could have held it aloft in front of people and everything.
No, I didn't get to do that. But we did, randomly, Amru Al-Kaidi, who won the first book prize, and I were both performing at the Polari Salon, like randomly, a couple of months before it was announced. And the gig was amazing. It was like in September. So it was like the first, we were actually allowed out, and we did an actual gig at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern. It was amazing, and it was like the best gig I've ever done in my entire life, like of any kind. I do improv comedy as well, and this was like better than any other gig. Then that's where we found out that we'd won. So like that felt like such a celebration, being able to like, and we didn't know, the audience didn't know, but we were told backstage that we'd won, and that felt like the best way to celebrate it, really. So yeah, I didn't really. I think someone bought me some like fizzy wine. Had some fizzy wine in my house.
Perfect.
When the announcement was made. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, I feel like I can just continue celebrating in a low key way.
No, it's really well deserved. So congratulations. And what you talked a couple of times about the novel you're working on now. So what is that? Can we expect a follow up or more of the same?
It is not a follow up or more of the same. It is a novel about donor conception. So I am a lesbian, obviously, and thinking about having kids and thinking about donors. And also, I'm a donor conceived person. So I've always known that my dad is not my biological father. And I was conceived by an anonymous donor in the 80s.
Right.
And so I wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about donor conception from several different viewpoints. So it's about a woman who discovers that she's donor conceived in later life. And when people discover that they're donor conceived in later life, they often find it quite traumatic and a big identity. Often people have a big identity crisis. So it's about that and her kind of quest to find her biological father. And also it's about her sister who's a lesbian and her journey towards having a child and like trying to decide whether or not she can use a donor now that she knows this about herself and how she was conceived. So it's kind of about donor conception from a few different angles.
Oh right, okay, that sounds really interesting. And how far along are you in that journey?
I've written a first draft of it and I'm doing another one.
Yeah.
So, and it's still funny. Mm-hmm. But it's slightly different. Not as much sex in it as you can probably imagine. It's not a lot takes place in sex clubs in that particular.
No, level. No, less sex clubs.
Not as much sex. Yeah, not as much sex.
Yeah, less sex, more sperm.
Exactly, more sperm about mortgages and that kind of thing. But yeah, I promise it's interesting.
So, and I also saw you went on a writing retreat to a castle somewhere in Scotland. Is that right?
Yeah, it was amazing. I never even considered that this was something that I could ever get, but I just randomly saw that you could apply for this retreat at the Hawth. It's called the Hawthornden Literary Retreat at Hawthornden Castle in Scotland. If you Google it, it'll come up. You just apply. You just email the guy, and he'll send you some forms to fill in, and you kind of have to write an application and send a bit of your novel off. And I never thought that I'd get chosen, and I did. And it was for a whole month. It's free. I mean, it's just amazing. Go and live in this castle for a month, and all your meals are cooked for you, and it's just like an actual dream. That you know, you have porridge together, and you talk to the other writers, and then there's silence between 9:30 and 6:30, and someone delivers your lunch to you in a Fortnum Mason's hamper outside your room, so as not to disturb you.
Wow!
And it is genuinely insane and amazing. So it was brilliant, and I got loads of work done, and I just kind of chilled out. There's no like phone reception, or you can get the phone if you walked out like up a hill, but there's no internet or anything. So it was really immersive, and I made some really good friends from kind of lots of people from America, and so we kind of still Zoom regularly. So I definitely recommend if anyone's thinking about writing retreats, this one is free.
Yeah,
so definitely worth a shot having a go.
That is amazing. Is it some sort of just somebody owns that castle and just wants to aid writers?
It was this woman called Drew Hines, who was married to like Mr. Hines of Hines tomato ketchup fame.
She's American. Okay, right.
And she had a lot of money, and she spent all of her money basically supporting artists and writers. And one of the things she did was she bought a castle in Scotland and she turned it into a writer's retreat. So yeah, it was thanks to her that she kind of set up this whole thing. And she lived there. She lived there until she died, actually. She loved it there. Oh. But yeah, she just wanted to help people, which is kind of an amazing thing to do.
That is cool. Yeah, whereabouts was it in Scotland?
It's quite near Edinburgh.
Okay.
So right in the middle of this beautiful countryside, but you can get a coach to Edinburgh for a day out if you want to. So it's not too isolated.
Okay. Yeah. So you said you were a full-time writer. Do you do other writing projects as well?
Yeah, I do. I do. When I first started, when I first kind of went freelance, I was still doing some editing, children's book editing, and I still write. So I write I've just written a book about fairy tales, an adaptation of fairy tales, kind of as bread and butter for my old children's publisher. Yeah. And I write picture books. So I write. There's a book called The Incredible Hotel that was published last year, and I've got a sequel to that coming out next year, I think. And then I'm writing for a Cartoon Network series, a really, really funny Cartoon Network series, which is like children's animation, which is kind of like back to my sitcom roots. So it's like pure jokes, really fun to write. And then I'm working on some TV projects as well. So it's kind of quite a lot of different stuff going on. And I quite like that. I quite like not relying just on my books. That puts a lot of pressure on it. But at the same time, you can spread yourself quite thin, which is why it's taken me quite a long time to write this one.
Yeah.
So I can't say no to stuff now and just like have to get this next draft done.
Yeah. Do you write all the other stuff under the same name, or do you have a different pen name?
No, I write it all under the same name. I kind of thought about having a different one, but I was like, well, Kate Davis is quite a generic name anyway, you know, so it's not...
Yeah.
I just thought, well, they can just, people can just assume it's a different one if they want to. I kind of like being a person who does random, lots of random different things.
Yeah, no, that's cool. You've got a portfolio career. That's what it is. Yeah. So do you have a favourite thing and a least favourite thing about writing?
The favourite thing is when you... lots of favourite things. Like that flow state, which I have not accessed for quite a long time, is the most amazing feeling in the world. That feeling where you're having loads of fun and it's just coming out of your hands. That is like literally like a high. It's amazing. Reading something about that you've written that you think is like okay is also an amazing feeling. And also writing stuff that other people like. Or that other people, you know, I get messages from people who've like really related to the book, or who, and also, I've had messages from people who've like become queer, but realise they're queer after reading the book. And I think that's amazing. Like, yeah. You know, that is an amazing thing. And I kind of don't think about that enough. Like that, to write a book that has had an impact is an amazing thing. And it makes it worth it. Things I don't like about writing is it's really hard. when it's not going well, it's so painful, and it's really easy to just think that you've lost it. I always think I've lost my touch, or that I'm like not funny anymore, or the jokes have gone, I've just used up all my jokes. That kind of feeling is really horrible, and just being kind of needs to just push through it, really. So sometimes it feels like really hard work, but it's worth it in the end because it's just making stuff up, really. I also find like the long deadlines for a novel very hard. I got a one book deal, so I could have had a two book deal, and I could have, you know, had like a year to write a book, in which case I would not have been complaining about the deadlines. But because I haven't, I find that really difficult to motivate myself, which is why I prioritise all the other kind of writing where, you know, it's TV and I have a week to do it, and so I'll do that. I find that quite hard. It's a bit like writing an essay at university and feeling guilty all the time.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. That's me and my book deadlines all the time. Have you learned anything about yourself and your writing in lockdown?
Yes, I've learned that I'm really bad at working at home. That's the main thing I've learned. And I've learned that I need to go out and to do things in order to have stuff to say. I definitely got to a point where I was like, I have literally nothing left to say. I've experienced nothing. I draw on my life and my experiences in my work. And when I was just sort of having the same experiences every day, I just felt really writer's blocky, if that's the thing. But I just really felt like I just didn't know how to keep going. And I really don't, I'm not a fan of working in one place, especially for a long period of time. So usually I go and work in a library. And that's like, I'm on my commute, and on my commute is where I read my book, and then I'm in this room with other people who are working, and I have a lunch break. And that, I find that so much easier to concentrate in that environment than I do at home, where the time just kind of bleeds into one. So it has not been my favourite period of time.
Yeah, no, I think everybody's been going through that, haven't they? And I'm really pleased that the cafes are back open, because, yeah, you know, just going for 2-3 hours writing in Costa does make a difference.
Really does, exactly. And that's how I wrote in at Deacon. I wrote it in pubs and coffee shops in like hour bursts. I think that's a much better way to write than the sort of like endless stream of time where she can just procrastinate.
No, I just had a golden 25 minute sprint before getting on this call where I wrote 1,000 words. I was like, ah, the day is better. So if you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
I don't know the answer to this question, because I write from my own experiences, so I wouldn't be able to be anybody else. But people I really like and would love to write like. I mean, I love Nora Ephron. I love her films. I love her novel Heartburn. I think it's amazing. If anyone hasn't read it, read it. It's so funny and it's so true. And that's the kind of writing that I really like. I really love a lot of David Nichols' novels, particularly One Day. I think it's, and Start of the Turn. He's very, very funny, lovely prose, brilliant dialogue. And he also is a great TV writer. So I'm kind of attracted to people who do those things well. Who else? I mean, you know, Muriel Spark. Love Muriel Spark. Really dry and witty writer. And I was thinking, like, Stella Gibbons, who wrote Cold Comfort Farm. Cold Comfort Farm is by far the best of her novels, but it's such a work of comic genius.
Mm-hmm.
So people like that, I think, okay. I inspire. Jane Austen. Pride and Prejudice is amazing. I reread that recently and was like, this is a perfect novel. There, it's hard to write a perfect novel. This is one of them.
Yeah. It stood the test of time, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So you're having a commune of parents, and that's all good.
That's no problem.
Cool. Excellent. Well, this has been fantastic, Kate. Thanks so much for taking the time. And where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Oh, I have a website, katedaviswriter.com. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram. But I'm a bit rubbish at social media, I'm not going to lie. But I'm there. So if anyone wants to get in touch with me, they can. And my handle is Katie E.M. Davis, which is K-A-T-Y E-M Davis.
Perfect. And if you haven't read In at the Deep End, go and read it. It's fantastic. And we'll look forward to your new novel coming out, whenever that might be. Don't have a date yet?
No, but I have promised my agent I'm going to finish it by the end of July. So, is the noise. So not too long away. But, I mean, not this year.
Okay.
Hopefully next year or the year after.
Cool. All right. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cool.
Bye.
That's the end of this Lesbian Book Clubs. This is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you'd like to find out any more about me or my books, just head on over to my website at www.clairelydon.co.uk. And while you're there, you can sign up for a free lesbian romance by filling in your email in the box at the top of the page. My books are also available anywhere books are published or streamed. Amazon, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Apple, Google, Bella Books, Ilva Publishing, and direct from me on my website. Again, that's www.clairelydon.co.uk. And there's always a bargain to be had. Thank you so much to The Lesbian Lounge for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And join me next month when I'll be having some more hot book club action. See you then.